Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the first week of May. I'm Nan Evans, and today my guest is Jim Bodkin. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with Jim about sea otters, those photogenic critters of the outer coast. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Okay, just a little hint. Listen around town for these critters, especially early in the morning and in the evenings. Well, I want to share this week with you the most amazing observation I had, and it's been a week or two ago. One day, my birding friend, Monica Fletcher, showed up at my house with her spotting scope over her shoulder, and off we went to see what we could see as we walked along North Beach. We enjoyed watching the flock of black oyster catchers working the shoreline, the few harlequin ducks that had not yet left for breeding grounds at higher latitudes or higher altitudes, and figuring out which of the species of cormorants we were looking at. At one point, Monica stopped. We were scanning the bluffs with our binoculars when she said, "There's something up there." A spot of gray that looked different than the surrounding bluffs. The scope was quickly set up and we found the prize. A handsome peregrine falcon, high on the bluffs, surveying its world. Through the spotting scope, we exclaimed over the deep, dark black hood and sideburns, then those startling eyes, big, black, and surrounded by brilliant yellow eye rings. It was watching us as intently as we watched it. Falcons have vision that's about equivalent to the magnification of our 10X binoculars. The breast was a clean white with dusky colored bars. As we watched, it would preen its feathers and clean its powerful bright yellow legs and talons. Oh, and I'm referring to the peregrine as it, simply because males and females are colored very similarly. We searched to see if we could find the nest, and finally, there it was, a small, untidy bunch of sticks on a nearby ledge. No chicks yet. But that peregrine was certainly keeping an eye on that nest. After watching for a while, we heard the call of its mate. Time to change roles between watching the nest and hunting. The peregrine lifted off the ledge and flew back and forth a few times along the bluffs. Well, I'm spending all of this week's time for observation on that peregrine falcon, not only because it was so exciting to spend time watching this spectacular, powerful, and fast-flying bird, but also because the peregrine falcon tells such a hopeful tale. Peregrines were virtually eradicated from eastern North America by pesticide poisoning in the middle 20th century, with DDT primarily. After significant recovery efforts, peregrine falcons have made an incredible rebound and are now regularly seen in many large cities and coastal areas. Now let's talk about another animal that has made a recovery from a brink of extinction, the sea otter. Earlier this spring, I attended a great presentation on sea otters that Jim Bodkin gave to the volunteers at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, and I immediately knew that I just had to invite him to talk with us on Nature Now. Jim recently retired to Port Townsend after a long and very impressive career with the federal government as a research wildlife biologist in Alaska with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jim's focus was, and probably still is, isn't it, on population biology, the ecology of marine mammals, especially sea otters, coastal marine ecology, and marine conservation. Jim has a long and very impressive list of scientific publications, but what really impressed me about the presentation Jim gave to the Marine Science Center volunteers was how he organized his talk and told the story to really drive home some very basic concepts about sea otter biology, their survival, and marine ecology. So welcome to Nature Now, Jim.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
First, let's be clear. We are talking about sea otters, a marine mammal, not river otters, those pesky critters we see locally on docks and decks of boats and in the bluffs. We are talking about sea otters. just briefly remind and distinguish for our listeners the difference between a river otter and a sea otter?
There's 13 different species of otters around the world, and most of those occur in the low latitudes, and nearly all of them occur in freshwater systems.
Like the river otters that I knew growing up in the Midwest.
Right, right. Although the river otters in Puget Sound and elsewhere along the coastal areas where they live often occupy salt water, and they'll live in marine habitats, and they'll feed in marine habitats, but they typically rest and do all of their other activities ashore or in freshwater, so they'll access both freshwater and sea.
So they're not really marine mammals.
Not exclusively,
yeah.
Although you'll certainly see them
in
the marine environments.
Yeah.
Probably the biggest difference between the river otters and the sea otters has to do with their size and their feeding habitats. The sea otter is the largest of all the otters. The largest one we've ever weighed was 112 pounds, and it was captured off the coast of Washington.
That's a hefty size.
Right. Well, that's nearly four times the weight of an average river otter. And they're nearly a meter and a half long. They're quite a bit larger. And probably the easiest way to tell them apart in the ocean is that the sea otter will often be found resting or feeding on its back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's consuming almost exclusively large marine invertebrates, things like crabs and snails, urchins and things like
mm-hmm.
that. But they're very similar in appearance, and they can be very difficult to distinguish.
So now that we're clear that we are going to talk about sea otters, where are they found? I, of course, have that iconic image that many of us have of photographs of sea otters off the California coast or in the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which has a endlessly fascinating exhibit. Tell us about sort of the range of the sea otter that we know around here.
Sure. So the sea otter is confined presently exclusively to the North Pacific Ocean. And it ranges from the northern islands of Japan, across the Aleutian Archipelago, through Russia, and through northern Alaska, and then down the west coast of North America to essentially, historically, central Baja California.
Hmm.
And so that's kind of its range. And within that range, it occupies almost all nearshore marine habitats. We don't know of any types of nearshore marine habitats where they don't occur. But they are limited in their offshore distribution to their ability to dive to the bottom to get food. Because they feed on benthic invertebrates, mm-hmm. animals that live on the seafloor, they have to be able to dive to the bottom to get their food. And their ability to dive is limited to about 100 meters or a little over 300
so
feet.
So that's near shore or around islands.
Exclusively and, near shore. Right.
Not the open ocean.
Although they can be seen many miles offshore when shallow water occurs offshore.
Okay.
There's places up in the Bering Sea where we might find otters 50 or even 80 miles offshore.
So let's talk a bit about kind of basic survival issues. The marine environment, as you know, can be pretty harsh. It's wet, cold, salty. How have the sea otters adapted to just to living in that kind of an environment?
They exhibit a number of different kind of adaptations from other otters that they're most closely related to. That's more common to marine mammals. And in particular, they give birth to a single young. So all of the marine mammals give birth to a single young. All of the otters, except for the sea otter, give birth to multiple young. So one of their adaptations to living in the ocean is a single birth.
Mm-hmm.
Another major adaptation is the development of their fur. They have the densest and by most regards the finest fur in the animal kingdom. And they use that fur as their insulation so that they can occupy cold waters.
Mm-hmm.
That fur is what kind of precipitated mm-hmm. their harvest. So they don't have any blubber like all of the other marine mammals.
Like the whales and the dolphins.
Right.
And the
pinnipeds. And so they use that fur exclusively for their thermal regulation.
That's interesting. No fat layer.
They have no subcutaneous fat or very little.
Well, I mean, we all have fat layers, but
right.
not a...
They don't use it as insulation.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, I'm thinking about that fur for a minute, thinking about as a pinniped, there was an elephant seal in town a few years ago. There have been several that come ashore for sort of their spectacular molt. Do the sea otters do that?
The sea otters don't annually molt. They molt continuously.
Oh, a lot of the fur critters
right,
we know.
Right. It's a kind of an adaptation that's a throwback to their mm-hmm. phylogeny, to their history.
Mm-hmm.
All of the otters have kind of a continual mm-hmm. molting period.
So the next kind of area of questions is what do they eat and How do they find their food?
They have a very diverse diet. We've recorded over 100 different species of prey items that they consume, but they're generally classified according to the types of habitats that they occupy. So in soft sediment habitats, things like sand and gravel or cobble, they're going to rely to a large extent on infaunal bivalves, things like clams primarily, but also worms. And on rocky substrate, they're going to eat things like urchins and crabs.
And they use their hands a lot, don't they, when they feed, rather than you think of sea lions really using their teeth?
They're fairly unique in the animal kingdom in that they've developed a capacity to use tools. So they will actually use stones as either anvils or as hammers to open hard shell prey, things like snails or abalones and clams, even some of the harder shell preys.
How do they get an abalone off the rock? I mean, I used to free dive for abalone off California, and it's a challenge.
Right.
How do they do it?
They do it with brute strength in most cases, but they will also use a tool underwater. So they'll break a shell underwater to basically get an animal off the rock. Abalone have a refuge in that if they can occur in a certain type of crevice that the otter can't get into, they can persist in those. It's really the exposed abalones that are kind of most vulnerable to predation by sea otters.
The Marine Science Center has a skull of a sea otter, and in looking at it, it is so impressive to me. I mean, the size of the nasal cavity is gigantic. And if you look in there, you can see really complex internal bone structures. What's that about?
It's, again, one of the adaptations that the sea otter in particular has. And it's really a way for them to see their environment. We tend to view the world through our eyes.
Right.
But sea otters and a large number of other animals have different means to view their world. And the sea otter relies heavily on the sense of smell.
Yeah.
It's largely how they detect other sea otters and how they communicate with one another. There's a ritualized greeting that takes place whenever an otter swims into a group, and they'll go from animal to animal. They'll thoroughly investigate them with their nose.
And they're mustelids.
They're mustelids.
So related to weasels and
skunks,
other sorts of and skunks
badgers,
and things that smell, and some things smell badly. Another thing, when I think about sea otters, I know they have a huge role as a sort of a keystone species and an important role in the ecology of kelp beds. Can you talk just a little bit about that part?
One of the attributes of sea otters is that one of their preferred prey items is the urchin, the sea urchin that occurs, throughout the world's oceans. When the urchins are reproductive, they have a very high caloric value to the sea otters. But the sea urchin is also a grazer. It's kind of analogous to maybe a sheep, if you will, in a terrestrial system.
Yeah, they just sort of chomp along on kelp and other algae.
Right, the urchin is a grazer. And in the absence of sea otters, when there's not this predation pressure, these urchins can grow in abundance and in size, and they can essentially deforest the seafloor from any kind of algae. So there's a kind of an absence of primary production in the system. When sea otters are absent and when urchins are abundant. But as sea otters have recolonized much of their habitat in the North Pacific, they've essentially reduced the urchins down to very small numbers and to very small sizes so that this grazing effect is removed. And this allows the kelp forests to flourish. There's a huge amount of primary production in the system, which...
And a habitat for lots of other critters.
Right, habitat and nutrition that finds its way up through the food chains. And we're doing some work now that just basically determines that most of the primary production in the nearshore system, even fishes that occupy a pelagic food web position, much of their carbon, and in fact, most of it is coming from kelps as opposed to coming from phytoplankton. So it really is an important role that otters play in many different respects related to kelp forests and nearshore ecology.
Thinking like an otter for a moment, if I were an otter, what would I be worried about in terms of predators, and what would I do to keep from being eaten?
You potentially have a large number of predators.
Even though it's such a high keystone feeder itself.
Right. One of the things that you do as an otter is you don't go ashore very often, or you don't go ashore where predators are going to be available. And those would be terrestrial predators, things like lions or bears or wolves. And that's why we don't see sea otters very often hauled out or coming ashore. Now, there's also a few marine predators that they have to worry about. Probably the most common one that we see throughout the otter's range is the eagle. The eagle is really only capable of preying on sea otter pups, newborn sea otter pups. So the female sea otter, when she has a newborn pup, which weighs somewhere around a few pounds, she will change her behavior. So she'll feed only at night because she has to leave her pup alone while she dives to the sea floor.
Because he'll stay at the surface.
He stays at the surface. So he's vulnerable to predation at that time. So mom will modify her behavior so she feeds more at night, and she feeds more in shallow water where the pup is left alone for a shorter period of time. The eagle is a predator, but only on a certain age and size of animal, and only probably for a few weeks before the juvenile sea otter learns to dive. And then there's sharks. There's a number of white sharks in particular in California have recently been recognized, although they've been known to be a predator on sea otters for a long time. It seems fairly evident now that their white shark predation is kind of limiting the northern expansion of sea otters up in the San Francisco Bay area.
Interesting. Well, I know that I could talk just forever with you, but I do have just a couple other questions. I'm, again, thinking like a sea otter. I need to reproduce. Tell me a little bit about that. Where do they mate? You already mentioned they only had one pup. Are they territorial?
They have a polygynous reproductive system where males occupy and defend against other males' habitat. And pretty much most of their range is divided up by these territories that a single male will occupy. And he will try to sequester females within his area. But the female is free to move from one territory to the other in general. So there's some choice by the female there. These territories are held for multiple years. They can be held for many years by the same adult male. The adult female, she matures at 3 to 4 years of age. She gives birth to a single pup annually. She is pregnant or gestating for 6 months, and she has a dependent pup for about 6 months as well. So there's an annual reproductive cycle. And the adult female is either gestating or lactating throughout her life.
And her life is about how long?
It's upwards of over 20 years. There's animals, the oldest animal that we know about is 27 years old in captivity, and we know of animals in the wild that have lived to be about 20 years old.
Okay. So I have one last question to ask you. And this sort of gets generated by the thinking about reproduction. The iconic image of sea otters are these sort of cute, playful, photogenic, sociable critters. And the visions of them in rafts kind of off the California coast is what I have. Are they really social? Do they have a social structure? Is knowledge passed down through teaching and learning? What's their social life like?
Yeah, they have a really complex and kind of social system. You might even view it as a culture. So within these territories that I described, there's preferred resting areas, and females will – and the associated male will occupy those on a daily basis for years. And these home ranges might be as small as a few square kilometers.
Not big.
An annual home range, right? So it's very small, and it's the same group of animals that live in these relatively small areas. And they interact with each other on a daily basis. So it's difficult to imagine that there isn't some communication.
Right.
We know that there's different types of
communications. There's vocalization going on.
There's vocalizations that take place. And we do know that at least the food habits of the individuals are transmitted from mother to offspring.
So teaching and learning.
If mom feeds on crabs and urchins, if that's her specialization, that it's most likely that her pup will have that same type of diet.
Yeah. I think we could just talk for a really long time, but I think we need to wrap up this part one of our interview with Jim Podgan. The second part of this interview, which will air later in the month, we'll talk about some of the challenges that sea otters have faced, such as the historic fur trade, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and sort of some more recent die-offs. Thanks, Jim, so much for this first part. And I'm looking forward to our discussion on sea otter conservation, recovery, sea otters in our world. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, let's hear that mystery sound again. That was the chirping and chatter of violet-green swallows, a beautiful swallow of open woodlands. The violet-green swallow is found only in the American West, and lately around Port Townsend, we have been treated to the sights and sounds of these small birds as they swoop and swirl as small flocks in the skies, catching insects. Watch carefully, and you can see the flash of their white bellies and the sneak peek of the small flash of white near the top of their tails. Let's look forward to events. Nature Now's multi-talented sound engineer, Charlie Flashman, will help me share upcoming events with listeners.
On May 7th, join Denny Van Horn and the folks of the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society for a birding field trip out in Nia Bay. More information is available at the Olympic Peninsula Audubon website.
And on Tuesday, May 10th, the Native Plant Society hosts a program entitled Wild Rice, The Curious Case of Aboriginal Grain Use in the Pacific Northwest. The talk will be at the Port Townsend Community Center on Tyler Street at 7 p.m.
According to the Jefferson Land Trust, you can start your day off with a dose of inspiration by attending their conservation breakfast on Thursday, May 12th at the Northwest Maritime Center. Come share in the wonderful results of grassroots environmental conservation in our community. Check the Jefferson Land Trust website for details.
Well, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news of the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have any comments, observations, or ideas, or even if you think you might be interested in joining our team of Nature Now hosts. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Be sure to scroll down that long list of podcasts to find the collection of Nature Now programs towards the end of the list. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is Peregrine by Richard Norton.
That's the reason why she flies, she flies so high. Yes, she flies so high in the sky. Shaped like a jet fighter, she's not colored like a flower. Falls from the sky, 200 miles an hour. 3,000 feet she will fall, it's a right of her birth. No animal is faster, she's the fastest one on earth. And she'll fly, she flies so high. Yes, she flies.